George and show this Humphreys guy in. George smacked his lips. Well, I can bring in dessert and coffee. Fine, Dan said, unwilling to argue. Do that. Grinning, George scooped up the crumb-littered tray in one hand and started for the door. Dan saw that the desktop was sprinkled with crumbs, too. Annoyed, he brushed them to the carpet. Teresa appeared at the door. Mr. Martin Humphreys, she announced. She looked tense, Dan thought. Humphreys must have really rattled her. Martin Humphreys looked quite young. He was on the small side, a couple of centimeters shorter than Teresa, and he seemed soft, with rounded shoulders and a waistline that was already getting thick, despite the careful drape of his burgundy blazer. He seemed to radiate energy, though, as he strode confidently across the office toward Dan's desk. Dan got to his feet and extended his hand across the desk. Sorry to keep you waiting, he said, making himself smile. Humphreys took Dan's hand in a firm grip. I understand, he replied. I'm sorry to intrude on your grief. His eyes told Dan that the words were nothing more than an expected ritual. Martin Humphreys' face was round, almost boyish, but his eyes were diamond hard. Cold and gray as the storm-lashed sea outside the window. As they sat down, George re-entered the office bearing a tray of pastries and the same carafe of coffee, with a pair of china cups and saucers alongside it. For all his size, Big George walked with the light-footed step of a dancer, or a cat burglar. Neither Dan nor Humphreys said a word as George deftly deposited the tray on the desk and swiftly, silently left the office. I hope I haven't kept you from your dinner, Dan said, gesturing to the pastries. Humphreys ignored the tray. No problem. I enjoyed chatting with your secretary. Did you? Dan said, thinly. She's quite a piece of work. I'd like to hire her away from you. Not a chance, Dan snapped. With a careless shrug, Humphrey said, That's not important. I came here to talk to you about the current situation. Dan waved toward the window. You mean the greenhouse cliff? I mean the way we can help the global economy to recover from the staggering losses it sustained, and make ourselves a pot full of profits while we're doing it. Dan felt his brows hike up. He reached for one of the delicate little pastries, then decided to pour himself a cup of coffee first. Dan's firm, Astra Manufacturing Incorporated, was close to bankruptcy, and the whole financial community knew it. I could use a potful of profits, he said carefully. Humphrey smiled, but Dan saw no warmth in it. What do you have in mind? He asked. The earth is in chaos because of this sudden climate shift, said Humphreys. The greenhouse cliff, yes, Dan agreed. Selene and the other lunar communities are doing rather well, though. Dan nodded. On the moon, there's no shortage of energy or raw materials. They've got everything they need. They're pretty much self-sufficient now. They could be helping the Earth, said Humphreys. Building solar power satellites, sending raw materials to Earth, even manufacturing products that people down here need but can't get because their own factories have been destroyed. We've tried to do that, Dan said. We're trying it now. It's not enough. Humphreys nodded. That's because you've been limiting yourself to the resources you can obtain from the moon. And the NEAs, Dan added. The near-Earth asteroids, yes. Humphreys nodded as if he'd expected that response. So, what are you suggesting? Humphreys glanced over his shoulder, as if afraid that someone might be eavesdropping. The belt, he said, almost in a whisper. Dan looked at Humphreys for a long silent moment. Then he leaned his head back and laughed, long and loud and bitterly.
Space Station Galileo. They were gaining on her. Still wearing the spacesuit, Pancho Lane zipped weightlessly through the lab module, startling the Japanese technicians as she propelled herself headlong down its central aisle with a flick of her strong hands against the lab equipment at a few meters. Behind her, she could hear the men yelling angrily.
If any of those dip brains have the smarts to suit up and go EVA to head me off, she thought, I'm toast. It had started out as a game, a challenge. Which of the pilots aboard the station could breathe vacuum the longest? There were 6 Astro Corporation rocket jockeys waiting for transport back to Cellini City. 4 guys, Pancho herself, and the new girl, Amanda Cunningham. Pancho had egged them on, of course. That was part of the sting. They'd all been hanging around the galley, literally floating when they didn't anchor themselves down with the footloops fastened to the floor around the table and its single pipe-stem slim leg. The conversation had gotten around to vacuum breathing. How long can you hold your breath in space without damaging yourself?
The record is 4 minutes, one of the guys had claimed. Harry Kirschbaum.
Harry Kirschbaum? Who the hell is he? I never heard of him.
He died young. They all laughed.
Amanda, who had just joined the team fresh from tech school in London, had the face of an angelic schoolgirl with soft curly blonde hair and big innocent blue eyes. But her curvaceous figure had all the men panting. She said, I had to readjust my helmet once during a school exercise in the vacuum tank. How long did that take? She shrugged, and even Pancho noticed the way it made her coveralls jiggle. 10 seconds, perhaps. 15. Pancho didn't like Amanda. She was a little tease who affected an upper-class British accent. One look at her and the men forgot about Pancho, which was a shame, because a couple of the guys were really nice. Pancho was lean and stringy, with the long, slim legs of her African heritage. Her skin was no darker than a good tan would produce back in West Texas, but her face was just plain ordinary, with what she considered a lantern jaw and squinty little commonplace brown eyes. She always kept her hair cut so short that the rumor had gone around that she was a lesbian. Not true. But she had a man's strength in her long, muscled arms and legs, and she never let a man beat her in anything, unless she wanted to. The transfer buggy that was slated to take them all back to Cellini was running late. Cracked nozzle on one of the thrusters, and the last thing the flight controllers wanted was a derelict transfer vehicle carrying 6 rocket jocks. They would be rebuilding the buggy 45 ways from Sunday while they coasted moonward. So the 6 of them waited in the galley and talked about vacuum breathing. One of the guys claimed he'd sucked vacuum for a full minute.
That explains your IQ, said his buddy.
Nobody's made it for a full minute. 60 seconds, the man maintained stubbornly. Your lungs would explode. I'm telling you, 60 seconds, on the dot. No damage? He hesitated, suddenly shamefaced. Well? With an attempt at a careless shrug, he admitted, left lung collapsed. They snickered at him. I could probably do it for 60 seconds, Pancho announced. You? The man nearest her guffawed.
Now Mandy here, she's got the lung capacity for it.
Amanda smiled shyly, but when she inhaled, they all noticed it. Pancho hid her anger at their ape-man attitude.
90 seconds, she said calmly.
90 seconds? Impossible! You willing to bet on that? Pancho asked. Nobody can stand vacuum for 90 seconds. It'd blow your eyeballs out. Pancho smiled toothily. How much money are you ready to put against it?
How can we collect off you after you're dead?
Or brain damaged?
She's already brain damaged if she thinks she can suck vacuum for 90 seconds.
I'll put my money in an escrow account for the 5 of you to withdraw in case of my death or incapacitation, Pancho said calmly.
Yeah, sure.
Pointing to the phone on the wall next to the sandwich dispenser, she said, Electronic phones transfer. Takes all of 2 minutes to set up. They fell silent. How much? Pancho said, watching their eyes.
A week's pay, snapped one of the men. A month's pay, Pancho said.
A whole month?